This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Governor Eric Greitens recently announced a one-time additional withholdings for the 2018 fiscal year. KRCU's General Manager Dan Wood spoke with Southeast President Dr. Carlos Vargas about this and what it means for the university.
At the very end of June, you sent us a note on campus that the governor was doing an additional withhold. And of course, we had budget cuts, and we may talk a little bit about that for FY18, an additional withhold. And what's the university going to do, and what's the plan going forward here as we get into this new fiscal year?
Sure. Well, yes, that is indeed true. You may remember there's been a series of events that have taken place starting in January of this year when we actually, first of all, before Governor Nixon actually left office, he actually had some withholdings for last year's fiscal year. Then as soon as Governor Greitens came in, he actually had additional withholdings. And then his budget for fiscal year 18, the proposal that he had contemplated a cut of about 9% in our appropriations for higher education in general. After a series of conversations and the legislature looking at it, the legislature eventually ended up with a recommendation of 6.58 reduction. However, by that time, the university, we had already taken action on identifying and contemplating a 8.5% reduction in our budget. So we went through that exercise during the spring semester. Eventually ended up coming up with a plan, actually not a single-year plan, but actually a multi-year plan to absorb that cut. And so when the legislature proposed a 6.58 reduction in budget, we had the choice of either reducing our cut to 6.58 from 8.5 or keeping it at 8.5. We chose to keep it at 8.5 because we were not sure that the 6.58 was going to hold. And at that time, Governor Greitens had not signed the bill to make it the law. And so we went with that. And as it turns out, Governor Greitens did sign the bill for 6.58 reduction, but then immediately he announced withholdings, additional withholdings for higher ed, which essentially brought back the cut to a level of 9%. So because we had already developed a plan for the 8.5% cut, what we needed to do, and that's what we're in the process of doing, is identifying additional money. The additional amount is about $240,000. So we are right now in the process of identifying those funds. So we are going to end up, as it turns out, with a 9% budget cut.
Which is what the plan was, I guess, initially.
Which was initially
the plan.
And
so we sort of planned for most of that.
Yes. So fortunately, you know, we didn't have to go back to the drawing board and start from scratch. We had it already there. We had already had all kinds of conversations with the community of the campus and the three campuses and in the Boothill. And so at this point, we had already a plan going forward. As you may remember, one of the characteristics of the plan is that we did not have to eliminate any positions that were filled, so nobody really lost their job as a result of this this situation. You know, we do have people who leave and people who come in for other reasons. Some people resign, some people retire, and you know, and some people are hired and all that. So that process goes on all the time. But we did not lose any field positions because of that. And so we're right now able to handle this, again, without having to lose field positions.
And, of course, some universities in the state have been making cuts to personnel. Mm-hmm. As of right now, from my understanding, that's going to be a last resort, I guess, for us. You've been saying publicly that that's something you don't want to do.
Right.
At least here. One of the other things that I've noticed that's going on is the voluntary retirement. So I guess there's going to be some sort of program for folks who are eligible to retire at the university to go ahead and take a retirement, which long term would be some savings to personnel.
Right, and that's part of the plan that we developed. So we went to the Board of Regents this month at the last meeting that we had, and we proposed to them a voluntary retirement incentive plan, and they approved it. So we're going to put that plan into effect, and it's going to start. There's going to be a window during which people can apply, and that window is about 60 days from August 15 to October 13, I believe. And so people are going to be able to apply their, I don't know the exact number, but it's over 200 employees who are eligible to participate. Again, it's a voluntary thing, so if people want to do it, they can apply. And then the university is going to look at, who we accept into the plan. The reason being that you don't want, if for some reason in a unit, there are two or three people that want to retire at the same time, that might actually, create a problem with the operations of the unit. So we're looking into that right now. But that plan will be in place immediately. I think by the July 31st or so, we're supposed to put on the web, the packages, the information for people to start considering that. And this will give them, the window ends in October 13 or so, it does give the opportunity for faculty to return to the campus and then engage in conversations with maybe financial planners that they may have to decide whether this is something that they want to take advantage or not.
Okay. One of the things that was approved, I guess, for 18 is a tuition increase. And I'm just curious, do you think that's going to affect recruiting at all? Is there any concern about how a tuition increase will, affect future students coming to the university?
That's always a concern that I have. It's a concern that we should always have. I am not of the opinion that a tuition increase is small, so it shouldn't matter. To me, any increase in tuition is something that we need to be very careful with and very thoughtful about. And we should not go into increasing tuition unless we have an absolute identifiable need for that. In this particular case, given that we are receiving a 9% reduction in our appropriations, I think we had to do that. Are there students that may actually find it difficult to go to college with a tuition increase? I believe so. There will be some. We're trying to do as much as we can to, we have been putting in place scholarships to help students. So we have right now, I think we have about almost 800 or so endowed scholarships that we offer to students in an effort to try to help them, deal with the. We have 734 endowed scholarships, and 18 of those really were new in fiscal year 17.
Well, that was going to be my question. My sense is that those have been increasing. There's been more scholarships being added.
Yeah, for students we to take have advantage been working of. Very hard trying to do that. That's an effort that we're putting in place, and many of these scholarships are actually from private donors. So, people contribute some funds, and then we endow the scholarship, and so they can continue to be awarded on a permanent basis. That's something we're doing to try to help students. But of course, you want to encourage students to do well in school. I mean, that's an important aspect of that really reflects the degree to which student can be successful is to do as much as they can to do well in school.
The Supreme Court, as you know, recently let part of President Trump's travel ban go into effect. So one of the things I wondered about is could we see a decline in international students here at Southeast?
Well, we are already seeing that, and I would say there are multiple factors. For example, I will tell you that there are some countries that have traditionally supported their citizens going out to getting an education, many of them coming to the U.S. Saudi Arabia is an example, just one that just comes to mind right now. And they, in some cases, have reduced the level of support internally that they have. So the number of students that go out to the world in general from Saudi Arabia comes down, and that affects us. So we have lost international students. That's just an example. So that's in some ways an unrelated reason for the decline. So we have had some losses. I'm not sure to what degree the travel ban in its present form is going to affect international enrollment. I have read actually some reports indicate that there's actually been an increase in some areas from some countries in terms of international applications. But I think it's early to tell what exactly is going to be happening. Certainly, the branding of the institution is very critical. If there are institutions that are well known abroad, and so those may be less affected than institutions that are not as well known.
That was KRCU's General Manager Dan Woods and Southeast President Dr. Carlos Vargas. After the break, we're talking minimum wage and the stigma of mental illness in rural Missouri.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Now we'll turn our attention to some statewide news. In late August, no Missouri city will be able to have a minimum wage above the statewide $7.70 an hour. That's a problem for St. Louis, where the minimum wage is currently $10 an hour. It's also blocked a long-running push in Kansas City. KCUR's Frank Morris and St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum found out what it means for workers and businesses in Missouri's biggest cities.
Alexis Strader works at a St. Louis nursing home. Sometimes she's assigned to hospice care, where she sees a lot of death.
It's many a times where someone, loved one, has passed away. Brothers or sisters that stay out of town come in and they thank us and hug us, and they even call and they know us by name.
St. Louis's minimum wage ordinance boosted Strader's pay from $9.70 an hour to $10 an hour this year, money she put toward groceries and her two kids. Her thoughts on Governor Eric Greitens not signing but letting go into effect a ban on any Missouri city raising the minimum wage?
We work so much, we're short already, and then it's like the government doesn't appreciate us at all.
Mitch Wax owns Cooperative Home Care, which provides in-home care to older and disabled people. This year's Missouri budget is providing lower reimbursements to Wax's company. He says he may have had to stop serving St. Louis residents if the minimum wage ordinance remained.
My business may be cut in half if I choose not to serve those people, but forget me. What about the people who can't get served? Who puts their meds together in a pill box tomorrow morning?
Urban Eats co-owner John Chen pays his employees at the South St. Louis restaurant at least $9 an hour. He doesn't have enough employees to be affected by the ordinance, but it did discourage him from hiring more people.
We really should find a way to, on one hand, try to solve the problems, the major problem, large issues such as poverty, income inequality. On the other hand, we really should not do that at the expense of our neighborhood and small businesses.
St. Louis Mayor Lyda Crewson has said she won't sue to preserve the higher minimum wage. I'm Jason Rosenbaum in St. Louis.
And I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City, where people like Terrence Weiss have struggled for years to boost the city's minimum wage.
Politicians in Kansas City and across the country don't just wake up, we'll give workers raises today. No, we had to march, strike, and rally to make that happen.
It happened twice. Weiss, who supports three daughters working at McDonald's, backed successful attempts to raise Kansas City's base wage this year and in 2015, only to see the Missouri General Assembly block it both times.
Just to see it ripped away by politicians in Jeff City with the preemption laws, to see all that hard work wiped out with the swipe of a pen, it's devastating. Yeah, really nothing to compare it to.
Weiss's fiancée also works in fast food, and he says they pinned their dreams of financial security on boosting the minimum wage. But Patrick Tuohy of the Show Me Institute, a libertarian think tank, says that's a false hope.
I do understand that politically it's very, very popular. It just doesn't work.
Tui says businesses adjust to more expensive labor. A study released last month showed that Seattle's minimum wage increase led to fewer hours for low-wage workers and fewer low-wage jobs.
Employers will move if they have to, or certainly give people fewer hours.
And if Kansas City's minimum wage were ever to almost double to $15 an hour, Tui says an influx of low-skilled workers from all over the region would make it harder for Kansas Cityans to get entry-level work. Charles Gaskin, an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, says raising the minimum wage helps low-income households, but it's a blunt instrument.
I use the analogy of a fishing net. So you'll pull up a number of people, a considerable number of people, but at the same time, you're going to get a lot of other people who were not in your intended group.
But Terrence Weiss says that for him, for his family, raising the minimum wage is a game changer. He's not letting go, and he's not alone. The group Missouri Jobs with Justice is gathering signatures to put raising the minimum wage on the November ballot across the state. In Kansas City, I'm Frank Morris.
To hear this story again, visit krcu.org. Suicide rates are higher in rural than urban areas, and the gap between is widening, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. KSMU's Jennifer Moore looks at the way stigma of mental illness is different in rural areas.
A small clinic sits on the main drag in Mansfield, Missouri. That's in Wright County, one of Missouri's 70 counties without a full-time psychiatrist, according to the Missouri Board of Healing Arts. But the county does have three psychologists, and one is Dr. Loretta Fuge. She says many locals are hesitant to make an appointment with her because they're afraid someone will recognize their vehicle here.
They know that Ralph drives, you know, a Ford truck. It's blue. So if they see a Ford truck parked in front of the mental health place, then they assume that that's what that's going on. So I think for them, a lot of times there's this like a fishbowl effect in that they assume that everybody knows what they're doing. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes people don't really pay attention. But I think there is very much this stigma that people might.
In its March report on the growing disparity between urban and rural suicide rates, the CDC says one way to help prevent suicide in less urban areas is to promote positive social norms like seeking help. Fuge says in rural Missouri, seeking help is loaded with stigma.
Because I think in rural areas, people tend to be strong and independent, and really work ethic is really high. And so if they see anything that that they feel like is not meeting that kind of that cultural view, then that they're somehow less than.
So she says she talks to clients about how normal it is to seek help for depression or bipolar disorder and how they're seeking a hand up, not a hand out. She tells them it's not about them having weak faith in God. It's a health condition, she says. As fact-based awareness spreads, stigma tends to decrease. And Fuge says she's noticing a trend here in Wright County. People are starting to talk about mental health more openly.
I mean, I've got referrals from the insurance agent or maybe from the bank or somewhere like that. Someone's been talking in and they said, well, sounds like you might be depressed. You might want to go up and they'll send them up here.
In Springfield, Paul Tomlinson is acting president and CEO of Burrell Behavioral Health.
Folks who tend to choose to live in rural areas perhaps have even more of a cultural ethos or ethic of, you know, rugged individualism and we take care of our own.
He's got a benchmark he'd like both rural and urban culture to reach.
When people go and get cancer treatment or heart attack and they come back to work, we give them parties and say, welcome back, you know, good on you, you know, mate, and all that. One of my stock statements now is I'll know we've really made progress with mental health stigma when we start doing that with after somebody's had a week-long stay in the psychiatric unit and they come back to work and we have a little party for them and bring cake and say, yay, good job. Good job. Recovery. Recovery is possible. Recovery works.
The CDC report says one suicide risk factor that's known to be highly prevalent in less urban areas is access to mental health care. Missouri is currently facing a severe shortfall of mental health professionals, and that shortage is most acute in rural areas. I'm Jennifer Moore.
To hear this story again, visit krcu.org. That music means that's it for today. And as a quick reminder, KRCU will be at the Cape Girardeau Public Library on July 29th from 1 to 4:30 to record your stories about life in Southeast Missouri for our new community project, Dear Heartland. To hear the stories from today's show, visit krcu.org or go to iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.